Excuse me. Hey, boys. Yeah, you. Yeah. Got something to say? Share it with the whole class.
Welcome to the Back of the Class, a guide to education from the kids at the back of the class. Thanks to those of us who are, those of you who are joining us and who have decided to follow us. We can be found in iTunes by searching the back of the class, and we can be reached via email at thebackoftheclass@yahoo.com. I really should start checking that email. Additionally, we have a blog for the show that can be found at thebackoftheclass.blogspot.com. Feel free to give us your thoughts. We'd love to hear them. We really want to see what you guys think about some of the idiocy that we talk about. Each week on the show, the two of us meet together and we talk about a topic of interest, and particularly looking at it through the lens of the K-12 perspective and the university perspective. As always, with me tonight is Dr. Daniel Curry Corcoran, the chief, the man with the plan, the top dog, head honcho, El Capitan. Welcome, Danny. How are you doing?
Thank you very much, man. It's great always to be here with you.
All right.
I look forward to these evenings.
Of course. So it's your task to introduce me, and you can't call me the chief or the top dog or the head honcho.
Well, that's me.
I'll accept El Capitan, though.
I would be, in fact, then introducing myself. And I'm here to introduce you.
Yes.
So it is a pleasure. Thank you for having me. I'm here, as always, with my dear friend, and colleague, and mutter brother, who runs all these crazy races with me. But really, the man who needs no introduction, the voice from the back of the class, Dr. Patrick O'Shea.
You're saying I'm the one who's yelling out all the answers, or yelling out all of the stupidity that comes from the kids at the back of the class?
You're just the one talking in the back of the class.
I do my share of talking, but we'll go on. Well, thank you for that. That's very nice of you. I appreciate that.
So the first thing I think about when introducing you is
my massive ego and my vociferous vocabulary.
Well, that's in there somewhere. I'll work on vociferous.
Yes.
Vociferous.
Okay, so today we're going to be talking about a TED Talk that was put on by a guy named Matt Goldman. And if you're unffamiliar with Matt Goldman was one of the founding members of the Blue Man Group. And the TED Talk is called The Search for the Aha Moments. And I thought this was interesting because...
I read that as, aha! Well, am I wrong?
No, I think that's just your dramatic nature.
Oh, okay.
I'm much more mellow than you. I was like, that's what I read it as.
You can talk about that all night.
But I thought this was would be interesting because, you know, as with most TED Talks, it's not very detailed, but it's basically laying out this guy's efforts to start a school. I would be interested in hearing before we get into the details as they are of the school that he's started. I would be interested in hearing your thoughts about his initial anecdotes about the music activity and the writing exercise, all of those things. Has anything like that ever happened to you in school?
You mean the very beginning when he was introducing?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was thinking about that.
That guy doesn't look much older than us, right? How old do you think he is?
I would say he's late 40s.
Yeah, so he was growing up in the
probably your age.
maybe.
He's definitely in the school at the same time.
Yeah, he's in my he might be in my age bracket.
My brother did, though.
Your brother had experiences like that?
Yes, 100%. You know, I think when I went through school, like this is one of the things Matt Goldman speaks about in the talk, is that he was never super academically inclined, right? He talks about that he was happy to get the C+. He was happy it wasn't a C- or it was a D+. For me, I was so obsessive compulsive in high school that I was driven to the A. So I was always in honors AP classes. Now, my brothers, were not. They were in more average classes and had a much different experience in terms of teacher feedback than I did. I think it's a little bit easier for teachers when you have a class of students who are all college and academic focus, you know, we're all, but when kids aren't and they're getting C minuses and they're getting B pluses, how do you give them appropriate feedback? I was more shocked by all the hands that went up in the audience.
Yeah, I was a little bit taken aback by just to kind of, for those of you obviously who haven't seen this already, he tells a story about where the first one is a sorting exercise. He goes, I don't even know what grade he was in, fairly early in elementary school, I guess. The entire class is sent down to the music lab, and the music teacher plays out like some chord on the piano and asks each student to stand up and sing that chord, like da da da, whatever the tone is. And based on how you do, you get sorted into one of two groups, A or B or whatever it is. And he was in, obviously he was in the group that was not able to sing the proper chord or whatever it was. And so he says that at the end of it, they said, all right, everybody in your corner, go back to your classroom. And that was the last music lesson that he ever had, which I don't, I that seems like something from a different era to me.
It's been brutal. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty brutal. Like, you kids over there, you're never going to be able to get it. I've judged you on a 3-second like tone test. Be that as it may.
The interesting thing for me is does that happen still today? I mean, when we talk about things like the achievement gap, when kids are pushed very early or tracked into non-academic courses, I would say it's as prevalent now as ever. It's just, it's definitely not been my experience as a white male. The experience that, like, when I think of feedback I was given, the feedback that I remember is positive.
Yeah.
Like, I was an English major in college, of course, so I can remember, I had to take a year of Shakespeare. So, I mean, the feedback that I can really stick out is the feedback I was given once where the professor said, I completely disagree with your premise, but I can find no fault in your logic. A plus. You know, I don't remember the bad. I went into teaching, I think, because of having good teachers. So, but I know it's people's experience that school is not a place of community building and how that's happening for our minority students. So, yeah, I'm not sure if it's any less these days.
Yeah, I think, I don't know either. I mean, I would like to think that we're not as brutal in the way we approach this stuff. Like, he tells another story about getting a paperback and it's got like whatever he's written it on. I don't know what the topic was, but he gets this paperback and the teacher has marked it with as good as I could expect or something like that, you know, which is horrid, which is absolutely horrible.
I mean, what the hell are you in teaching for?
Yeah. I honestly don't know. I mean, these also, listen, this is his own retelling of the story and it could be apocryphal for all we know. I don't know. But as I was listening to it, I was reminded of something that, I had heard, what is that astrophysicist guy? The really famous, oh, I can't remember his name.
Stephen Hawking?
No. The current guy. The guy who...
Stephen Hawking is current?
Well, no. I'm talking about, like, he's very social media savvy. I can't remember what his name is. He'll come to me.
Oh, Neil
deGrasse Tyson. There you go. Thank you. Yeah. Neil deGrasse Tyson was telling a story on an interview on Fresh Air or something, some NPR show. He told this interview this interviewer that he had been asked to come back to his school to talk to the students about the benefit of an education and all this other stuff. And he told the school, I'm not willing to come back and talk to the students because the schooling wasn't what helped him succeed. Apparently he had known what he wanted to be from a very young age. Had figured out that he wanted to be an astrophysicist and was really passionate about it. But his teachers were not supportive of it. Everybody was the school was not supportive of it. And he succeeded in spite of his educational experience rather than because of it. And so when his school asked him to come back and talk to the students, he said, no, I'm not going to talk to the students because it would be lying to them to tell them that my education is why I'm here. And I stuck through my education in order to be here. He said, if you want me to come back and talk to the teachers, I'd be happy to tell them what not to do. But I'm not going to come talk to the students. And I got that sense when I was listening to this guy, the Blue Man Group guy, that's what he would want to tell as well. It was very disheartening for me.
Yeah.
But having said all of that, he went on to succeed and was a founding member of the Blue Man Group and is probably pretty wealthy now and has decided that he wants to go on and start his own school.
That's right. Because he's a successful Blue Man Group guy. We are now an education entrepreneur because what idiot can't do education?
Hey, I have problems with that statement because I think that sometimes the people who have had the worst experience in education are the ones we should be listening to most.
As long as you're surrounding yourself with people that, and I think he has, I went through and looked at the board. I went on his website and I went on the Blue School website. I think there is a canon to education. There people are wrong or right. And I think he talks about that. And when he goes through his list of things that make up the school of clear intent, purpose, and passion. I think one of his key things there, of course, that I can identify with is embracing multiple perspectives. Mm-hmm. I think here we have a man who has a vision and a passion and has realized that he wanted to bring in people that know about teacher training. Mm-hmm. One of the things that know about teacher training, but aren't stuck in any particular model of how teachers should be trained, but have some expertise in the literature and what's going on and how to do it and scale it and things like that. So
yeah,
that's what he did. So then that's good. I mean, you can have a vision. And I like that he took that. I think that's what you need to do. It's the same thing when we were toying around with our school and the XQ Super School. You know, we surrounded ourselves with people that had different perspectives, mm-hmm. or different experience, you know.
Yeah.
None of us have the exact answer to this. Well, I do, but I mean.
Well, that's the thing. I don't think there is. To quote our dear friend and mentor, Dwight, there is no A answer. There's a whole bunch of the answers. So I guess that's more of a paraphrasing than a quote from Dwight, but.
You know, one thing about that, though, is how do we scale anything then? That's my biggest thing. Even when I look at this, the search for aha moments, how do we take these aha moments and make anything out of them? Or is that just kind of, I don't believe that's what we're destined to do in public education or private education, is that we have a bunch of aha moments. Now, that has somewhat been my experience in when my girls were younger and we were looking into charter schools. The things we went to is there was lots of people that had aha moments. You know, they were in probably a public school setting or private school setting and two or three things did not click with them. So they were like, aha, or as you would have it, aha.
No, it was, That's what I would.
You know, and they went on and they said, hey, we're going to get some funding. We're going to make this our reality true. And, you know, they got a space and they got some students. And they're plugging away at an educational program. And I applaud them for that. But I mean, I guess my issue is I want to attack the issue of the other 75,000 kids that aren't able to participate in this. So if we have a bunch of little aha moments, how do we scale those up and reinvent our system?
Yeah. Well, I think this gets to a couple of the kind of through points that we've been talking about since we restarted this podcast. One being that everybody's an expert on education because they've gone through education. And so it now becomes pretty easy for anyone with the resources to start their own school and say, no, this is the way it should be done. Right. And, you know, maybe they stumble upon one of the correct answers, and maybe they don't. Who knows? Maybe they're in it for the profit motive and they just want to make some money off of the cash cow that is public education. I don't know. But some of them, I would hope, obviously, have the best of intentions at heart. But to answer the question of how they scale, I think it's also incumbent upon public education as a whole, in whatever structure it is, whether it's locality based, whether it's state based, whether it's the federal government. I think it's incumbent upon them to be looking at these other models and looking at what works right with them and in trying to incorporate them into the model. And that's how things can scale. It's not, you're not going to scale.
How you build Frankenstein.
What's that?
It's how you build Frankenstein.
But it's also not like, how are you going to start out with, that's how we've gotten to the public school system that we have now. It started out as a bunch of individuals doing whatever they could. And all of a sudden, you just patchwork these things together. And we have the Frankenstein that we have. What's wrong with inventing a new Frankenstein or designing a new Frankenstein? And by the way, just to be pedantic, it's Frankenstein's monster that we would end up with, not Frankenstein. Yeah.
This is
Mr. English major.
I apologize. one of the things that I want to talk about in a future podcast, and I was touching a little bit tonight when we were, texting back and forth about our topic this evening. Let's take a step back to the Horizon report we talked about, and more specifically in K-12, the role of the teacher. I thought it was interesting that I think we have a couple of things going on. We've got the internet, right, that has fundamentally changed teaching in terms of available resources, right? I don't have to, honestly, I don't have to sign up for a biology class anymore. I mean, I can go out there and there are probably 12 to 15 universities that have a whole biology curriculum that I can sit in front of my computer and actually have office hours with a professor and move forward. So in the Horizon report, it talked about the role of the teacher. And I was fascinated that the role of the teacher has gone from previous reports of being a trend or being a positive to now being a dilemma. Because I figured out that we've all figured out that changing the role of the teacher is extremely difficult. Because one of the things I think teachers are concerned about, I spent the better part of my work day today talking with a teacher who's now working in the IT office. And one of the things she was mentioning is that I think teachers are somewhat genuinely scared that if my role, so I'm a believer that why do we go home and we're all still inventing the same lesson, right? We have five teachers and they're all preparing to teach unit one tomorrow. Why am I developing my own PowerPoint? There's got to be six of them out there about this topic. So teachers are concerned, well, if I'm just harnessing free resources that are available on the web, like in the free, if we talk about flipped classrooms, if I'm just going to harness these free resources and put them together in some type of instructional, I have a printer going right next to me. I apologize. It's what happens when you have a home office, a home podcasting office. I think teachers are, how do we shift teachers from this idea of content delivery to actually delivering knowledge to actually going out there and molding a young person to think differently? And that's why when we were talking about it, it seems like this model is very slow to change because public schools are ingrained to, we have a curriculum department that writes curriculum, that creates frameworks, that creates assessments. And, five or six years down the line, the administrative team has moved on to other jobs. So then we have new curriculum leaders that have new ideas for a curriculum and new ideas for different frameworks. So we get this idea of how do we speed this process up? And that's where I was talking about this idea of rapid instructional design, of, getting teachers together, harnessing free resources, and shifting people's minds to less design, more facilitation.
Mm-hmm. See, it's interesting that you talk about that, because I've been coming at that. I've been grappling with the idea at the university level. We're basically tasked with trying to research in our field, and the idea of publication and all of this stuff, there's a patina of rigor to it, because you go through, you do the data collection and analysis, you write up the results, you submit it to a journal, it's peer reviewed, you get feedback, you modify your submission, you submit it again, it's accepted, and eventually a year later it's published. And I've been struggling with the idea that that process is so outdated for our fast-paced changing environment, particularly with technology. Mm-hmm. That I've been toying with the idea of doing like rapid prototyping research kind of things. So I'll give you an example of this. I oversaw a doctoral student who finished this past fall, graduated in December. And he had been working on his dissertation for about 3 years. And his dissertation was to explore and analyze one mobile app, one app on an iPad that was designed and sold to the school district as helping students with autism in their communication abilities, helping them learn to communicate better. And so he spent, 3 to 4 years observing students, writing up results, and basically ended up finding out that the app didn't work. And, that's all well and good. It got him his doctorate, but how does that help anybody to spend that amount of time on one app that doesn't work? There's got to be a better way to do it. And so where you're talking about curriculum design and doing that more quickly, I would be interested in finding a way to analyze the tools that we use much more quickly and get the results out to the end user more meaningfully.
Well, I think just the technology we have, these days, 10 years ago, we didn't have the technology that we have now to do this rapid prototyping, or, to go online and, search for, okay, I need lectures on biology. Let me pick four of them that I can live with. Right? There's a blog out there that I'll cross pollinate. It's called it was actually their family friends, and she writes a blog called The Good Enough Mother. Why can't we just be good enough educators? And I'm not saying that in terms of being less than excellent. I'm just saying, if we're talking about biology and we're talking about cells or we're talking about fractions, there might not be the perfect video or perfect presentation out there, and we would do it differently. But if we're able to use that resource and two other resources, that saves us a great deal of time as educators to focus on things such as calling parents or setting up conferences with students or giving feedback. It just facilitates, we can really change our work structure from creating content, which takes time, to harnessing free content and that's already available to us. It's kind of like, I'm always doing different reading and different things like that. It's almost like how the software world has moved to, kind of like the agile movement, where instead of having a software product that we're going to try to roll out in 2 years, every 3 week period, we're going to have something that we're producing. Mm-hmm. And it have to be, I'm not saying we're experimenting on kids, I'm just saying that it's very difficult to meet the needs of kids where they are in terms of, it's kind of like what Matt Goldman talked about here when he talks about, if you go on a school's website, it talks about academic mastery. I don't know what that is anymore. Yeah. I mean, is academic mastery taking an algebra test and passing the test? Is that what we classify as academic mastery? Well, it might be academic mastery on that day. But if we go back and retest kids in 6 months, do they still have that academic mastery? And I just think it gets to the work that UI, Dwight, and Jen Kidd, were doing when we were looking at basic ECI 300 introduction class for students in the ed school at ODU. This idea of rewriting the textbook, Was it perfect? Absolutely not. Did students read the whole textbook and have to create sections? Yes, they did.
Yeah.
That's where we need to move to. So we're talking about rapid prototyping. We're talking about rapid instructional design. We're talking about agile. These are things that I think the education can take from and say, you know, if it's going to take us 2.5 years to write a curriculum, that is 2.5 years of students that we haven't met their needs.
Yeah. And we're not going to end up with the perfect curriculum anyways.
We never are. Curriculum is going to be completely written. It's going to be completely rewritten because kids are going to take assessments and they're not going to do particularly well on particular areas. So we're going to rewrite the curriculum rather than saying, maybe we need to just take the curriculum we have, right? And we need to harness free resources that are available on the internet and package them in a way that teachers can use with the technology that they have. Then teachers can spend more time as kids come into the classroom working with Patrick, and Patrick needs help on section 2.4 and two other students, and Daniel's doing this, and really get to the idea of individualizing instruction. Because we continue to go into classrooms and tell teachers, you need to personalize instruction, and teachers are continuing to look at us and say, I don't know what that means.
Yeah. Or even if they do know what it means, I don't have the time to do that with 25 students in front of me. I just can't.
Yeah, because I'm preparing for tomorrow's lesson.
Yeah.
Because the curriculum changed.
Well, I guess this might get to the question of whether it's scalable or not. I think that it's the scalability is whether you feel like it's even a desirable thing or not. I know that there are some people who would say that we shouldn't always be aiming for scalability. But if we do want to, say we find a model of education that we think could work for those 75,000 students, how can we make it available to them? I think that we can, then it's incumbent upon there to be communication among all of the parties. The school itself has to document its successes and understand and be able to demonstrate to the larger audience that what they're doing is successful, while at the same time, it's incumbent upon centralized K-12 and university education to listen to those arguments and be adept enough to incorporate some of those practices. But this, you know, I would understand, like, I understand the reticence if we're talking about making a new Frankenstein's monster out of the Frankenstein's monster that we already have. Yeah. So we're trying to take the components that are already there and reconfigure it. That's troubling. What we may need to do is just, I fantasize sometimes about scrapping the whole thing and restarting. And this is never going to happen. It's not feasible, obviously, but sometimes in my darker moments, I feel like that's what's necessary to actually make the meaningful change.
My darker moments. It was actually a quote in the summary, but it was a quote I took out of the video as well. You know, Matt Goldman, he says, you know, we need to cultivate safe and conducive conditions for new and innovative ideas to evolve and thrive. And I think we live in a society of people of different opinions. So I just, when he talks about things of, you know, of creating these safe and conducive conditions for new and innovative ideas to thrive, I mean, I think that gets to the pillars that he used around, you know, setting up the school. This idea of, you know, personal integrity or direct communication and clear expectations, yeah. You know, grit and perseverance, you know. This is what allows these things to thrive. We need more teachers involved in this process. We need teachers who are in the classroom every day who are going to come out and say, you know, I really appreciate what you're doing, and it doesn't work, or it does work for A, B, and C reasons. And we need to take that feedback into account rather than just telling teachers what to do every day and expecting them to implement. Because you know what happens? Ultimately, they don't implement because it's not going to work in their classrooms. Right. And that's kind of finding ways to involve teachers during the day is a challenge. And we need to continue to figure that one out.
See, I think that that might, that's a great point. And I think that it might be the means through which things are able to be scaled. Because right now, the changes that are being made are all top-down kind of changes. And if the model was more of a crowdsourcing contributory model, where the end users of the stuff are responsible and at the core of creating the model, rather than being told what to do, then everybody wins. That's what we did with the ECI 301 stuff. We gave the content creation off to the students and tasked them with bringing information into the setting. Why can't we do that on a larger scale with university students as a whole, or with K-12 students and faculty? There's nothing that says that we couldn't.
No. I think we just need some grit and perseverance.
That's right. All right. Well, we've been at for almost for more than 30 minutes. So why don't we switch over?
Time just flies when I talk with you, man.
Yeah. Well, it does. That's because we get into this stuff. And we're I don't think it's surprising to anybody that we're passionate about these things. And we do want to change the world. We're not very successful at it, but we do want to change it. We got lots of thoughts about how to do that. But let's at this point move over to our Mutter Minute. Is that what we were calling it?
The Mutter Minute. I don't know, but I really like the Mutter Minute because that's about all the time I have for tonight.
I was thinking, I was kind of reflecting because I'm having a little bit of a knee issue right now that's holding me back from doing a lot of running and is putting my long-term future into question.
Did you hear that?
It's the sloshing of a camel pack. Yeah. No, I mean, listen, at some point, we're going to be too old to do this stuff. It's just human nature, right? Are we going to be the 80-year-old guy who's running up and down Black Diamond Mountains at Wintergreen? I doubt
it. Probably not.
So the question is, are we going to go out on our own terms, or are we going to go out by being forced to go out? And I don't know how at some point I'll walk away from this and I'll never do another mud run again, but who knows? I don't know. Maybe I'll be that guy who shows up at World's Toughest every year, does a lap, sleeps all night, and wakes up and does a final lap. I don't know. Maybe I will be that guy.
There's always a place for you on my pit crew, man.
That's right. But what I've been thinking about is reflecting back on last year, and I'd be interested in hearing, like, I was trying to figure out what I was most proud of from being involved with this kind of experience from last year. And I have a couple of thoughts, but I'd be interested in hearing what you're most proud of from last year. Was it World's Toughest? Was it all of the work that you put into actually preparing for World's Toughest? Was it the 8-hour race that you were able to do? Was it, what was it?
Sorry, I lost you there for a second. Actually, I had...
You got family stuff going on?
It's like, have you seen that video where
the guy comes in?
The guy's in. Like the Korean Peninsula and his kids walk in? Well, yeah. It happens when they're 12, too. Just the dad, I can hear you.
The drama's just more intense when they're 12.
Yeah. You know, for me, I have two really proud moments when I think back on last year, because, I was in a little bit of state of transition and trying to think things through. And one, I really like where I got to in terms of my own discipline and training. So I've never been at the place where I was in terms of actually being dedicated to trying to accomplish a goal that I had set out to do. Now, the course was absolutely ridiculous for me. And, I got up to like a 25 mile training run. I mean, I've been there as an athlete. And for me, it was just the perseverance of getting out there on the weekends and getting it done.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was the first time I've ever set a goal and like that and actually been there. It's the best shape I've ever been in terms of being a runner. So I was proud that I got there and stuck to that as a trainer, regardless of how results panned. And man, I was generally happy with my performance. But the real thing, and I'll be honest to God with you, the thing that I'm most proud of, and this might be a little sappy, our listeners might get a titch on this, but honestly, it's the relationships that I've actually, when I look back on, it's the relationships that you, Brian, and I have formed since 2011. And the reason I say that is because of what Brian, again, for what he did. So this was one of our friends who's, if you go out to our blog, yearinthemud.com, Brian is a fellow educator friend of ours and has become a true friend and mudder brother. And, you know, he didn't feel like he was prepared to run this year, which I completely understood. But I got a call from him maybe 6 weeks, 8 weeks before the race that says, you know, I'm not prepared to do this, but I don't want you to go out there and do it by yourself. I'm going to come and be your pit crew. I mean, to me, it actually brought a bit of emotion that he would do that for me. So I'm most proud that over the past 5 years or whatever, that we have that type of relationship where we do help one another, or either on the course or off the course, but are looking out. And honestly, I don't know how you get through that race without having some type of pit crew. I'll just tell a funny story. So I ended up finishing about 9 a.m, somewhere in there. And really, I don't think I could have went back out. It felt like my right foot was broke. I mean, I would
change it just a little bit. I wouldn't say that you finished at 9 a.m. I'd say you quit at 9 a.m. But that's all right. Go ahead.
As you will. So anyway, so I kind of went back to the pit and sat in the chair and was getting something to eat. And next thing I knew, our entire pit area was cleaned up. I passed out. I physically passed out in the chair. I must have been out for an hour and a half in a wet suit.
Oh, man. But, you know, it's horrible.
He cleaned everything up and he got us out of there. And it was just a tremendous. So I'm proud of, you know, the training I did in the relationships. And that's way more than a mudder minute.
Yeah. No. When I look back at the big lesson that I will always remember from our time in the mud, our years in the mud, it's not individual races. It's not individual obstacles. It's the relationships that we've formed. And that's, I mean, I don't think I'm breaking any ground. In fact, I posted a blog post about this a long time ago about the positive benefits of peer pressure, being that I would have been perfectly happy probably retiring after the first one, thinking that was an event, that's cool, because I don't think I'm speaking out of school to say that I don't think either you or Brian really enjoyed that first race. I'm pretty sure you didn't. I would not have thought twice about you guys saying, hey, that was great. It was an experience. I feel great that we finished, but I'm never doing that thing again. I wouldn't have held it against either of you because of what it was. But to both of your credits, neither of you said that. You said, this is just a start. This thing's not going to beat me. It's gotten into my blood. And because of that, you really are. The two of you are my brothers. And I last year, my goal was to get to 35 total events. And I would have done them all on my own, but I wouldn't have enjoyed them nearly as much if I hadn't been with you guys and been with, like, even just the car rides. I'm talking, you know, that stuff's fun.
I can tell you, being on the course at 2 a.m. without somebody out there definitely sucks.
Ah, well, it'll be different this year.
Yes, sir.
But just to let you know what, like, physically I was most proud of last year, it wasn't a mud run at all. It was running Hadrian's Wall. That was the thing that I felt most proud of having finished.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
I mean, it was just, in looking back at it, because I wasn't able to go to World's Toughest, I mean, that was the big thing that I did, and I succeeded at it. And I look back fondly at that.
Nice.
I think I'm going to put up a blog post about that.
Maybe I'd like to read that.
Yeah, my experience doing it with some maps and all of that stuff.
That's right. Yearinthemud.com.
Yep, yearinthemud.com. All right. Well, anyway, Daniel, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me today.
It's always a pleasure.
Yeah. And Simon, wherever you are, we miss you, buddy.
We do miss you, Simon. Be careful wherever you are.
All right. Bye.
Yeah.